From NPR and WBUR, I'm Robin Young.
I'm Jeremy Hobson. It's Here and Now, and President Obama is in Laos today. He is the first sitting American president to visit that country, and in his speech today, he said the U.S. has a moral obligation to help the isolated Southeast Asian nation heal its war wounds. He said too few Americans know of the United States' covert bombing of Laos during the Vietnam War.
The United States dropped more than 2 million tons of bombs here in Laos. More than we dropped on Germany and Japan combined during all of World War II. It made Laos per person the most heavily bombed country in history. As one Laotian said, the bombs fell like rain.
The countryside in Laos is still littered with thousands of unexploded bombs, and President Obama today pledged $90 million to the effort to find and remove those bombs. The president was supposed to meet today with the president of the Philippines, but he canceled that meeting after Rodrigo Duterte called President Obama an SOB and warned Obama not to challenge him over extrajudicial killings under his leadership in the Philippines. Duterte now says he regrets the remark. Joining us now from Manila via Skype is Richard Heydarian, professor of political science at De La Salle University. And how is all this playing in the Philippines?
Right. I think the opinions so far have been very divided, even among staunch Duterte supporters. I think some people felt that, the Western media was misrepresenting what Duterte was saying, that Duterte was just swearing in general and not directing it towards Obama. But, you know, others, Duterte supporters were perhaps saying that, you know, in general, when we talk about heads of states of very important allies like the United States, especially someone as charismatic as Obama, who's very much beloved in the Philippines, you should not use expletives at all. And then the rest of the population are essentially saying the guy is out of line, that he should not have done that, and this is going to create irreparable damage for bilateral relations.
Well, it did sound in what I was reading about this that Duterte was trying to stir up some kind of anti-colonial sentiment from people who know about the history of the U.S. as a colonial power over the Philippines.
I'm going to sound very controversial, but I think this will help your audience to better understand this person. I know that Duterte is very much compared to Donald Trump, and for understandable reason. But actually, imagine Donald Trump and Bernie Sanders combined. That will give you a better picture of what Duterte is. If you listen to Duterte, he's full of very strong leftist progressive criticisms of the empire. You see the echoes of his Vietnam era days in college. You see a lot of communist socialist sounding rhetoric. He talks about America's crimes against its own minorities, African Americans in recent decades, and of course against Native Americans in the past centuries. So he's basically saying, you know, how dare the United States to lecture me on human rights when you have to look in the mirror and look at how problematic the U.S. society continues to be until today. So he's using this anti-colonial language to essentially ward off any criticism on human rights concerns in the Philippines and basically telling to Obama that, you know, you have no business to criticize me on human rights. Get your own house in order first.
Although it does sound like President Duterte expressed some regret about what he said.
Oh, definitely. Actually, he said that he's not going to pick a quarrel with Obama. And the next day during the meeting fora itself, he immediately said that he regrets the statement. It was not directed towards Obama. And you know, the usual explanations that his team provides for his off-the-cuff statement. But to be fair to President Duterte, he's really fond of having spontaneous speeches and press conferences. I think this also reflects the weakness of his public relations team. Now, I'm not trying to excuse what he said. It's absolutely inexcusable, the expletives he's using. But to be fair to Duterte, sometimes he tends to really go off the trail and essentially, engage in offensive language without exactly meaning it. But without a question, I think he really feels annoyed by the United States. And he feels that when it comes to his war on crime, his war on drugs, he will not tolerate any criticism, including from major allies like the United States.
Do you think, though, that the more brutal aspects of his war on drugs, and we're talking about more than 1,000 people killed since he's taken office, that those will stop because of the international attention and condemnation?
I very much doubt that. I mean, if you look at surveys in the Philippines, if you do focus group discussions, as I have been doing in the past few weeks, it's very clear that the significant majority of the Filipinos, we can't say how big, but it's clearly a majority of Filipinos, are very supportive of him. I mean, he's known as Duterte Harry, and his argument is, you know, I could be a tough guy, I could be a foul-mouthed person, but I'm the tough guy for the people. I'm going to fight the real bad guys. And that kind of punitive populism seems to be appealing to a lot of people who feel that previous presidents and leaders in the Philippines just simply didn't have the guts to go after organized crime and influential criminals.
That's Richard Haydarian, who's a professor of political science at De La Salle University, joining us from Manila in the Philippines. Richard, thanks as always.
My pleasure.
Well, this has been a rough wildfire season in the western U.S., extremely hot and dry, many regions seeing less than 25% of normal rainfall, a lot of land destroyed. Last month's Range 12 wildfire in southeast Washington state burned more than 176,000 acres, much of it valuable habitat on the Hanford Reach National Monument. Now, the monument was set aside in 2000 by President Bill Clinton. It's one of the last protected places for many sensitive desert species. Anna King of Here and Now contributor Northwest News Network took a look at how the now charred and blackened swath of land looks.
Heidi Newsom unlocks a tangle of padlocks, then pushes open a 12-foot-wide metal gate. Newsom is a wildlife biologist with the federal government, and she's closely managed this dramatic desert landscape for nearly two decades. But now, this place she loves for its beauty and solitude feels greatly disturbed, eerie. We roll onto the reach. Everything's gone, shadowed with black ash.
It was a little frustrating, and I was upset.
Usually, it's beautiful here. The reach has long been a tightly protected swath of land. First, an enforced security buffer around the Hanford nuclear site. In 2000, it was set aside as a protected federal monument. That's kept it from grazing, the plow, and development. Within its bounds, Rattlesnake Mountain and the last undammed stretch of the Columbia River. It's been home to hundreds of elk and dwindling species like sage grouse and burrowing owls. Now, a lot of that's gone.
I've cried before, and I'll probably cry again after I get over the shock of what's happened.
Our first stop, a burnt-up desert oasis called Rattlesnake Springs. We have to hike there.
Okay. Wow, you can smell the char out here.
Yeah. It smells like ash and dust.
We weave through stark greasewood shrubs and grass and sand. Sweat and dust mingle on my face. Finally?
Oh, it's like a huge canyon, kind of like a grotto. And there's these beautiful trees. What kind of trees are these, Heidi?
These are mostly Pacific willows, and there's some black cottonwoods there.
This once lush place is all fed by an ancient underground spring. A few of the trees have managed to escape the fire, but a large chunk of this oasis isn't suited for flocks of migrating birds anymore. Back in the truck and further along, Newsom negotiates deeply rutted sandy roads and the ash. Usually there are sagebrush, bunch grass, and desert crust here. Now there's nothing holding the talcum-like soil. Newsom says dust storms are already popping up, and there will be running mud later on when the rain and snow hit. Still, some species are benefiting from all this destruction for now. A half-eaten dead snake tells the tale. This guy, small mammals and lizards, have little cover from raptors like hawks and owls.
They'll have a lot of prey for a short time, and then it's going to be very little prey for a long, long time until this recovers.
Recovery time. That's the problem. Newsom says fire is coming too often. Should be every 50 to 80 years, not every 5 to 10. The slow-growing desert species here can't recover.
It's just one of those things, I guess, that you pick yourself up again and go on, you know.
For Heidi Newsom, that means planting trees, protecting them from elk with tall fences, and planting pencil-high sagebrush. Two previous fires scorched hundreds of thousands of acres in the same area. With this year's fire, some sensitive areas have been burnt over three times in the last 16 years. Now Newsom is working on a plan to help restore 3,500 acres, just a fraction of what was destroyed on the Reach this year. But she's competing against other land managers for resources, with increasing fires across the West. For Here and Now, I'm Anna King.
A new movie collection has been released on Blu-ray, and it's a must-see for film fans. Film critic Jay Hoberman wrote in the New York Times, "From the perspective of cinema history, and American history for that matter, there has never been a more significant release. It is Pioneers of African American Cinema, a five-disc set that features restored films from black filmmakers dating back to 1915. Kino Lorber released the collection, which features 16 feature-length films, some short films and documentaries, fragments of lost films and trailers. Filmmakers like Oscar Michaud, Spencer Williams, Pearl Bowser, and author Zora Neale Hurston. Martin Scorsese says this very special collection illuminates one of the most fascinating and unjustly neglected corners of American movie history. So, let's pay some attention. Charlene Register is Associate Professor in the Department of African, African American, and Diaspora Studies at University of North Carolina, Chapel Hill. And Professor, so you hear these accolades from others. Your thoughts on this new release?
Yes, this is very important because most of these films are inaccessible, particularly if you teach film history. And so you would have to go to a variety of archives in order to have access to some of these films. And these films were actually assembled from the Library of Congress, the Museum of Modern Art, the National Archives, Southern Methodist University, UCLA Film Archives, George Eastman Museum. So a variety of archives came together to contribute whatever they had in their collection to assemble this reemergence of black cinema.
Oh, and released by the company Kino Lorber. Well, start with Oscar Michaud, self-taught filmmaker. He was a Pullman porter, a South Dakota homesteader, and then a dogged filmmaker. More than 10 of Michaud's works are in the set, including his 1925 Body and Soul. It's a silent film, but just your thoughts on, you know, Body and Soul and Oscar Michaud's works.
Okay, Body and Soul featured Paul Robeson in his first screen role, and many people forget that he was in an all-black cast film, Michaud's film, before he appeared in other films. And the film is really about a corrupt minister who exploits a faithful church member's daughter and tries to extort money from her. And at the end of the film, the woman dies, and the church members come to their sort of sense about who he really is. And at the end of the film, you see the church members running behind him.
So tell us more about the fact that, you know, this is entertainment and perhaps even a little bit of a cautionary tale about a corrupt minister. But for black audiences, these were not just black actors, but black filmmakers. These were called race films.
Okay, and race films were designed to appeal to black audiences because the films that were released by the mainstream industry did not, to some extent, speak to their desires, their culture, their religious beliefs. And Body and Soul, because it is about this minister, is about how religion can be used sometimes to influence African Americans in a negative way. And how this corrupt preacher becomes indicative of that. And when we look at many of Michaud's films, he was very critical of African-American ministers who misled their audiences. So I think the film served two purposes, to both entertain as well as alert them of persons who might exist like this in the African-American community.
The oldest film in the collection, 1915, Two Nights of Vaudeville. It was produced by Ebony Film Corporation in Chicago. Now, they employed black artists, but it was a white-owned company. Flying Ace from 1926, directed by Richard E. Norman, a white filmmaker who produced films starring African-Americans. You know, talk a little bit about the intersection of whites and blacks in these early African-American films.
Well, apparently a number of white filmmakers recognized that there was money to be made off black audiences, so they too began to participate in creating films designed to appeal to these audiences. And in particular, with respect to Ebony Film Corporation, there's some criticism in the press where they provided damaging and denigrating images of African Americans, even though they are hiring all these black actors. Richard Norman, who was affiliated with the Norman Film Manufacturing Company, he in fact provided a much more positive representations of African Americans. So his films were more well received within the African American community.
The 1941 film, The Blood of Jesus, by Spencer Williams, according to Jay Hoberman, this is the most successful of the race movies made, screened for years in church basements and black-only theaters. Let's listen to a scene from this. It's about a man who accidentally shoots and kills his wife and then the journey of her soul. Here she meets her temptress, Judas Green, an agent of Satan who's offering her fancy new clothes. Satan can be seen. He's watching through the trees. And then the other voice is that of an angel. Let's listen.
You'll be needing something like that in the city. And look. Yes, shoes to match it. And just to think, they're your size. And they are all yours, too.
Be not over anxious for what you shall put on. Life is a more wonderful gift than clothing for the body.
Why, in the city, a girl would be a queen with those on. And you know you've got to wear clothes. The law says so.
Your heavenly Father knoweth that ye have need of all these things.
Go ahead and keep them. They don't cost you anything.
Okay, I know it was a very important film because it was about black religion. And even though this black woman is shot, it's about her faith that she will come back to life, which she does. But at the same time, the film is also about people who are lured by the inner city and by the sins associated with the inner city versus those who are affiliated with a much calmer and less seductive kind of life. So it's about the juxtaposition of those two worlds, the evil world and the sacred, I suppose.
Well, and that faith, religion shows up a lot in these films. James and Eloise Gist were husband and wife evangelists in the 1930 Hellbound Train and Heavenbound Traveler. These were dramatized sermons?
To some extent, they were. And this is actually a very short film. Eloise Gist was from Washington, D.C. And it also has this sort of moral that if you follow the world or the lead of sin, you will, you know, end up with a very harsh life as opposed to following the word of, you know, the omnipotent being. And what is interesting is that in this film, and this is also something I noticed in another film, they equate this pursuit of a better life, of a more moral life, with traveling on a train. So the metaphor of the train becomes a way of how they are able to access this more moral world versus an immoral world. And this is an interesting kind of metaphor because it speaks to modernity and how blacks viewed train and travel as a way of transformation or transcending oneself.
There are, of course, lighter films. There's the 1939 Bronze Buckaroo. It's an interpretation of cowboy movies with an all-black cast. Here's a scene. They're singing in a saloon.
Took my room and went to town with some gal and played around. And she cut my bank, rolled out her payday blue. Rolled a dice to my surprise. Not so nice to snake eyes. And I never will get wise or hook at the payday blue. Now I am confessing. Got that gambling craze. Will I learn my lesson? Oh, I'll be broke for 30 days.
Charlene Register, how much of this filmmaking was subversive? We see in other films there's mocking of blackface.
In many of these films, it was an attempt to subvert the caricatures. In fact, there's one scholar who refers to this phenomenon of what he calls hybrid minstrelsy. And he's basically saying that when white actors performed on stage as minstrels, they imitated African Americans. But then blacks in some way subvert that when they take these caricatures and replace themselves as African American actors who are performing imitations of blackness themselves. So in that way, I guess it could be regarded as subversive.
And according to just about everybody who's reviewing these were the first independent filmmakers. These are the first indie films.
Oh, yes, particularly with people like Oscar Micheaux. Also, there were the Lincoln Motion Picture Company, George and Noble P. Johnson. They were among some of the first filmmakers. And, of course, William Foster out of Chicago. None of his films survived, but he, too, represents some of the early first in terms of black filmmaking and recognizing that black audiences wanted to see images of themselves on screen. And it was not only for U.S. audiences, but there was also an international market for some of these films.
Well, indie filmmakers, pay attention. These are your forefathers. Charlene Register, Associate Professor in the Department of African, African American and Diaspora Studies at the University of North Carolina, Chapel Hill, on this new collection, Pioneers of African American Cinema, a five-disc set featuring restored films from black filmmakers dating back to 1915. We'll link you up at hereandnow.org. Professor, thank you so much.
Thank you.
Music from Spencer Williams' 1941 film, The Blood of Jesus. And we mentioned Oscar Michaud, who died in 1951 and is buried in Great Bend Cemetery in Great Bend, Kansas, where he grew up. His gravestone reads, "A man ahead of his time." Well, he may be a new name to some of us, but just how much ahead of his time he was is seen in the esteem in which he's held. There was a 2014 documentary about his life. There's an Oscar Michaud Society at Duke University. In 1987, he received a posthumous star on the Hollywood Walk of Fame. The Producers Guild of America created an annual award in his name. Gregory, South Dakota holds an annual Oscar Michaud Film Festival. And the Black Filmmakers Hall of Fame in Oakland, California every year hosts the Oscar Michaud Award. Attention must be paid, and apparently it is.
ITT Technical Institute, the nation's fifth largest for-profit college, announced today that it is closing all of its campuses across the country and laying off nearly 8,000 employees. ITT's parent company blamed the federal government for the closure after the Department of Education last month banned the school from enrolling students who get federal financial aid that made up the majority of the college's revenue. Jason Bellini of The Wall Street Journal joins us from New York with more on this. Hi, Jason.
Hi, Jeremy.
So what happened here, and was it a surprise?
Was it a surprise? Well, it couldn't have been that big of a surprise because the company, ITT, derives 80% of its cash revenue from federal aid that includes Pell Grants and student loans. And so this was basically the death knell when the Department of Education banned it from enrolling new students who receive federal aid.
And why did the department do that? And by the way, more than a dozen attorneys general across the country have also been investigating the school. What are the concerns about ITT?
Well, the concerns are, one, chronic financial mismanagement, and the second one, questionable recruiting tactics. And the Education Department said in late August that it pretty much lost faith that ITT would survive this audit that it was conducting of it, and that's why it went ahead and banned it from taking new students relying on financial aid. ITT denies charges against it, said those sanctions are unconstitutional. But they realized that just couldn't save themselves.
And what happens to all of the students who had been enrolled at ITT? There were still 40,000 students as of June. What happens now with those students and the loans that they may have taken out from the federal government?
Very good question. Now, ITT's CEO spoke with reporters today and said that Daniel Webster College, I gave this as an example, which is one of its brick-and-mortar campuses in New Hampshire, began its fall semester as scheduled, and it's going to remain in operation for now. But for how much longer, who's to know? But, I mean, the implications for taxpayers are pretty tremendous. I mean, we're now on the hook for loans that these students took out to pay for school, and that tab could come to as much as $500 million, though at least $90 million of that could be covered by funds that ITT has already set aside, but still a huge amount of money. This is coming from the Education Department. That said, students who withdrew in the past 120 days, they can have their loans discharged. Again, taxpayers, you know, covering that tab, and they could then restart their college careers from scratch somewhere else.
And there has been a larger crackdown by the Obama administration on for-profit colleges, schools like the University of Phoenix and Kaplan University have also been investigated. How is the for-profit college industry doing overall outside of ITT, which, as we said, today announced it's closing all of its campuses? How is the industry doing overall, and have the actions of the Obama administration been working?
Well, as a, overall, not so well. I mean, this industry has been pretty much shriveling in recent years due to the government crackdown, really cracking down on their aggressive recruiting practices. You also have, these days, a better job market. And so prospective students are less inclined to sign up for the additional training that these schools tend to offer.
That's Jason Bellini of The Wall Street Journal on the news today that ITT Technical Institute, the fifth largest for-profit college in the country, announced it is closing all of its campuses across the country and laying off nearly 8,000 workers. Jason, we'll keep following this. Thanks.
Thank you.
Gail Forman is best known for her best-selling young adult book, If I Stay. It centers around Mia, a young woman whose entire family is killed in a car crash. But from If I Stay and YA, Gail has now moved to an adult book titled Leave Me. Her heroine now, Mary Beth Klein, an overcommitted 44-year-old mother of twins, barely balancing family and a job with her husband Jason, who also depends on her. Mary Beth doesn't feel well, but she's got to get to her accountant's office with those late tax returns. Then she really doesn't feel well, but how can she go to the doctor? The school firmly tells her there is no aftercare. You have to get the kids. She finally gets to the hospital where the doctor's trying to tell her what? She needs surgery or something? But as she explains, she has too much to do.
In the coming days, someone had to get the kids to their ballet classes, their soccer clinics, their speech therapy sessions, their play dates, their birthday parties, to take them shopping for their Halloween costumes, to the pediatrician for their flu shots, to the dentist for their cleanings. Someone had to plan the meals, pay the bills, balance the checkbook. Someone had to get it all done while still getting all the work done. Mary Beth sighed. It's just I have a house full of four-year-olds and a very busy weekend. He stared at her for a long moment, frowning. Mary Beth looked back, disliking him already, and that was before he said, "You do realize you've had a heart attack."
That's Gail Forman reading from her new book, Leave Me. She joins us from the NPR studios in New York. Hi.
Hey, Robin.
You know, that scene is so reminiscent. I don't know if you remember, Larry King's book was actually titled, Mr. King, You're Having a Heart Attack. This idea of, you know, trying to get it across to someone. We will get to what happens next, but a heart attack, a mother with a heart attack. I understand this is personal to you.
Well, yes, the idea of it came about 5 years ago when I was on a family vacation with my two young daughters and my husband and our friends with their kids the same age. And it was this really wonderful vacation. We were at the beach and the girls were doing cartwheels out on the lawn and we're having these communal meals together, except that I'm hiding upstairs with my cell phone trying to get a signal to Google heart attack symptoms and when it's so bad, you should call the ambulance. And it wasn't just complete hypochondria. My mother had bypass surgery when she was 48, and it was kind of a shock to us all because she didn't have any of the risk factors aside from apparently some bad genetic luck.
Right.
And so it's always been in the back of my mind. And as I waited to, I didn't call an ambulance, which is very stupid, and people should actually call if they're in that situation. But when I finally saw a doctor and had a stress test while I was waiting for that to all happen, I was imagining, what if I did need the surgery that my mother had. It's a brutal surgery. And I had these two young kids. And who was going to take care of them? Because I worked from home and I was the default mom. And who was going to take care of me? And that terrified me. And it also made me angry. Mm-hmm. And I think I started the book really as a revenge fantasy, this idea of this mother who has a heart attack and in the aftermath, nobody's taking care of her and she runs away from home. Eventually, I went to the cardiologist and it was not my heart and the urgency sort of withered away. But then I picked up the book about 3 years later and Mary Beth was there very much as a character, but it took on a different dimension, you know, beyond the sort of revenge fantasy cri de coeur of the working mom.
Right. And it sure did because you had another element. I want to get to that. But, people just heard you say, she what? She runs away from home. And here's where we wander into Kramer versus Kramer territory. That's the late 70s movie that shocked people because, you know, a notion that a mom, played by Meryl Streep, would abandon a dad, played by Dustin Hoffman, to go off and, well, we don't really know what she did.
Right.
Because your book is from the mom's point of view and that movie was from the dad's. Did you think of that, Kramer versus Kramer?
Absolutely. I mean, I thought of it in a lot of ways. I wondered if that movie would even get made today, number one. And number two, yes, absolutely, because you are with the father and you are with the son, and Meryl Streep seems very cold, and it all seems so incredibly selfish. At least that's what my childhood recollections of the film mm-hmm. was, and I didn't want to rewatch it while I was working on the book. And here, I'm hoping that people, even if they find Mary Beth's actions unforgivable or shocking, they're also somewhat relatable and they're sympathetic to her.
You've added another layer. You talk about being conscious of your mom and that affected how you thought about your health. And so you were thinking about a possible heart attack because your mom had had one. Mm-hmm. You give us a character, Mary Beth, who's adopted and has no idea what her genes are.
Right. Has no idea and has told herself throughout her life that she doesn't really care and she doesn't need to kind of pull on that thread. But then when she has this heart attack, she doesn't understand how could this have happened. And did I do something wrong? And there's almost a need to find out, was there a genetic component? Although, you know, in the end, I don't think that's truly why she goes right. looking for her birth mother.
Well, she leaves an email at home with her husband saying, I've had it. And by the way, you mentioned briefly, I just want to fill it out a little more. The surgery is one thing, trying to figure out who's going to pick up the kids, you know, while I'm having a heart attack. But the recovery is almost impossible. Everybody's still, and this is a kind of an evolved husband. And she ends up, I mean, I was kind of going out of her mind for her, that she couldn't have a recovery. Did doctors tell you this happens? I mean, you researched this.
Doctors didn't need to tell me that happened. I've been in situations myself, whether it's recovering from a minor surgery or just, you know, I remember one day when my older daughter was a baby and I woke up in the middle of the night and my eardrum had burst and it was just horrible pain. And my husband had to go to work the next day and I was home alone with her. And just that feeling of like, I just want to take care of myself, but I can't because I have to take care of this other human. And I had heard this fantasy that women have about hospital stays because it's like this one opportunity you have to go and take care of yourself and not even feel guilty about it because it's a medical necessity. But for Mary Beth, maybe the hospital stay is somewhat of a break. But getting home, she has sort of set it up so much. Everybody relies on her. Everybody is leaning on her so much that they just do not know how to be leaned on. And she does not know how to really ask for that help or accept it or feel entitled to it.
I think one of your characters even says, oh, yeah, the surgery to get mom, you know, out of the house for a little while. Yeah. So there's that, some women, you know, begging to get into the hospital to get out of the house. But on the other hand, women not paying attention when they're obviously having a heart attack. I mean, when the film is made, and I'm betting it will be, I can just hear a narrator voiceover reading your words. And in fact, Mary Beth did not even know that at that moment, her heart tissue had begun to die from lack of oxygen.
You know, it's not obvious, though, with women. I think that's why heart attack is such a killer among women, because it doesn't necessarily feel like this. I think we all have this idea of this classic, like you have the pain in your left arm and you clutch it and then you pass out. And for a lot of women, it's just this sort of nausea that comes on, or it's this low-grade pain. And that combined with some of my tendency, obviously, to rationalize it all away, it can be very dangerous.
Right. Well, she, as we said, does finally realize and then just runs away. She's had it and goes to Pittsburgh to find her birth mother. Obviously, you did some work here, too, about just how hard that can be, but the organizations that exist and the counselors that help.
Well, there was two elements of that. I mean, one of that is sort of a research that I did just as a mother. My youngest daughter is adopted, and I started to see, particularly with her, but I imagine that this is not uncommon, this emotional wound around why did my mother leave me? And even if you have an answer to that emotionally, I'm not sure you can ever have an answer to that. So then I started doing some research in Pittsburgh, and I called up one of the sort of oldest existing adoption agencies there, and had a woman there who helped me out and told me kind of all about the process there. And then there's sort of things that are real that you couldn't really make up, such as the fact that it's called the Orphans Court, which things like that are just so shocking that they could only be true.
Well, and this takes us back to how this is nothing like Kramer versus Kramer, because while she takes off, her husband, and I don't want to give too much away, but it's a very different story. He's more evolved. He's angry. He's upset. But there's some understanding. It's a 2016 book, not a 1970s book.
I hope that readers will have a different view of Jason when they finish the book as when they start the book. And I think that, yes, he is indicative of husbands and fathers today, where they are much more involved. And yet there's still this sort of this gap and this expectation that the default parent and the worrier in chief and the person that just kind of carries the emotional load, who does the emotional work of the family, is still the mother. So Jason being who he is, when Mary Beth is not there, you kind of find out what happens, but you don't really know for most of the book because you are squarely with Mary Beth. So all you have are her fantasies and her fears about what's going on. And those range from everybody's falling apart to perhaps even worse, they're all doing fine without her.
Right. Perhaps even worse. Gail Forman, the book again is Leave Me. Gail, thanks so much.
Thanks for having me.
21st Century Fox, that's Fox News' parent company, has settled a lawsuit with former anchor Gretchen Carlson for $20 million. It's been just 2 months since Carlson sued now former Fox News chairman Roger Ailes for sexual harassment. 21st Century Fox also issued a statement today apologizing to Carlson for how she was treated at the network. NPR media correspondent David Folkenflik has more on the story. He's with us from New York. Hi, David.
Hey, Jeremy.
Well, a lot of incredible things about this settlement, including that apology that we mentioned. Give us more details about what we know about the settlement with Gretchen Carlson.
So the settlement's $20 million. A portion of it will be paid by Roger Ailes himself. Of course, it's a note that rankles some of Carlson's supporters that he actually received a payout of at least $40 million himself to walk away when the Murdoch family, which runs 21st Century Fox, wanted him gone. But that said, this is a huge payout. I've been trying to contact lawyers and law professors who deal with sexual harassment cases, and there are few, if any, settlements out of court that reach this level. And the apology, too, is pretty forthright. I want to quote briefly from it. They go out of their way to praise her, saying during her tenure at Fox News, Gretchen exhibited the highest standards of journalism and professionalism. We are proud she was part of the Fox News team. And they go on to say, we sincerely regret and apologize for the fact that Gretchen was not treated with the respect and dignity that she and all of our colleagues deserve. I've got to tell you, the lawyer who represented Gretchen Carlson said to me, she's never gotten this kind of money, but also never gotten this kind of apology from someone she's has essentially been suing before.
And I assume that now that we've got this settlement, we're not going to be hearing much more from Gretchen Carlson about this, including there was some talk that she had tapes of being harassed by Roger Ailes.
Well, more than talk. She clearly had direct transcripts of almost every instance that she cited in her lawsuit. I want to be clear, the suit was filed against Roger Ailes individually, but Fox News needed to step in and make this go away. And this is how they were able to do it, also an effort to show that this was a change in culture, something that she cites and it says that she appreciates that 21st Century Fox did there, notably in her remarks, while she said she wants to move on and serve as an inspiration and a supporter of women in the workplace. She doesn't praise Fox News at all in this. She praises 21st Century Fox for its actions after her complaint was filed.
Well, and does this go away, David? Because there are a number of other women who have also said they were sexually harassed by Roger Ailes.
Right. So 24 women, more or less, have come forward and cooperated with the legal review that was instituted by 21st Century Fox in July in the wake of the Carlson lawsuit. Most of those complaints appear to be about Roger Ailes, although others may be complaining about sexual harassment at the hands of other colleagues at Fox News. In this instance, I can confirm that I have had sources confirm for me that two other complaints raised by women during this suit and during this review have been settled by Fox News and 21st Century Fox. They were allegations that happened within the statute of limitations of them filing a civil claim in court about this. Other allegations appear to have predated the statute of limitations. Therefore, they wouldn't themselves have a legal basis to sue.
I want to ask you about another big story at Fox News today that happened almost – it was announced almost at the exact moment that we learned about the Gretchen Carlson settlement, which is that another big name at the network – is leaving. Let's listen here to Greta Van Susteren.
It's a Trump's life, and it's a special on the record. You will hear from Melania and Ivanka Trump. Yes, Donald Trump's wife and older daughter. They are the two women who know Trump better than anyone else.
Now, that's a voice that people who watch Fox News know very well. She's been at the network for a long time, host of On the Record. Britt Hume is going to come in and replace her. But what's happening here with Greta Van Susteren?
Well, she posted a statement on her Facebook page today saying Fox has not felt like a home to me for a few years. She said she exercised what's called an out clause, allowing her to get out of her contract, even though she has said publicly that she has a long-term contract in place. And another source told me that this was a dispute about money, indicating that Greta Van Susteren had asked for more money above her current rate of pay and that Fox didn't want to pay it. I must say that it does come the same morning as all this takes place. You know, she was one of the most avid defenders of Roger Ailes when Carlson first filed her suit in early July. She said to me – or excuse me. She said on the record, I don't like it when I think someone is being falsely accused or wrong. She pointed out that she had been a lawyer for many years. She said, this one's wrong. Based on my experience, she called Carlson disgruntled and said she didn't get her contract renewed and therefore the timing is suspicious. She said that part to the New York Times. You know, these are very strong statements just trying to, in a sense, undercut and discredit Carlson. There were others who did so at Fox to defend Ailes. But, you know, what Greta Van Susteren did was seen as kind of indefensible and insupportable given the wave of women who came forward offering extremely similar narrative spanning decades but also having taken place in recent years, including apparently Megyn Kelly, the most prominent female at the network herself.
And I have to say, when I saw that Greta Van Susteren said she wants to stay in broadcasting, you know, and this is pure speculation, but you put together this with some of the other stories out there about how, you know, if Donald Trump doesn't win the presidency, he's going to get together with Roger Ailes and Steve Bannon of Breitbart and put together a new right-wing network. And I don't know, maybe we'll see Greta there. We can't confirm any of that, David. I'm just putting it out there because just piecing together a lot of different stories about this ongoing saga at Fox News that have been going on. David Folkenflik of NPR, thank you so much.
You bet.
And Here and Now is a production of NPR and WBUR in association with the BBC World Service. I'm Jeremy Hobson.
I'm Robin Young. This is Here and Now.